Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So it's nice to be back at Abhayagiri. For those of you that live here or visit quite frequently, you'll know that I've been away for it's over 6 months now, and just spent most of that time up at the Pacific Hermitage, filling in for Ajahn Siddhanto. And say Ajahn Yaniko started off there at the beginning of this year, and Ajahn Kurnadamo then filled in for about 4 months, and so the three of us took turns being the senior monk there while Ajahn Siddhanto was on a year sabbatical. And so the last month though of being away was I wouldn't say hectic, but I've been doing a lot of traveling. So at the very end was actually still 2 weeks to go, and say your winter retreat. But we went up as a group to welcome Ajahn Siddhanto off of his retreat, which was I think really nice. So I think there was about maybe 10 in our entire group. Seven lay people came up and got to do basically a week of retreat at Bergen Monastery up in British Columbia. And Ajahn Siddhanto was still on retreat for most of that, so we didn't get a chance to see him until like the day before we left. And so he came out. One thing is kind of from that time of traveling up there and talking to Ajahn Sona, the year before that, he had done a year retreat. So we were asking him, what it was like for him to come off the retreat and kind of maybe even trying to get some, insights like what might be going on for Ajahn Siddhanto coming out. And it was beautiful. Ajahn Sona's response was, asking him, how it was coming off retreat. He said, "What makes you think I came off retreat?" And that was really a nice reflection. And so the community here, it's been 2 weeks since we've been off retreat, but we've probably noticed, some changes in our attitudes, our commitment to practice. I've noticed a lot of people since I've been back have been really quiet, not so talkative as it can be later in the year when we're trying to get all the work done before the winter retreat. And so it's still, to me, coming back, I get a sense of the quietness of the community still. You may not be experiencing that yourself because you will be being asked to do more, taking on responsibilities. But I think it's important to pay attention to that you could just get lost in the activity and just start, let that peacefulness, that settledness dissipate without really knowing it. And so there will be times where we are going to be asked to do more, but just bring it into consciousness that at some level there probably is a bit of maturing that happened during that retreat period. And if you're aware of that, then that can be a basis for a continuation of the solid meditation practice, studying the Vinaya, just learning how to be in community and to be supporting each other. This morning, so I was just before the talk here, I was kind of figuring it out in my head, but so when we left the Pacific Hermitage and to go up to pick up Ajahn Siddhanto, from there I traveled to Indiana where my parents live, and have been promising my sister for years that I would go down and see her new house that she purchased, and I never actually had the time to do it, so I really wanted to make a effort to go down to see her, and then spent a few days at the college I attended in the town that I grew up in. And from there, visited a friend in Chicago before I met up with Lumpur and Danny down in New Orleans. And then when we were down there, we did quite a bit of traveling, staying in various places. And then even when we came back to California, we still stayed someplace before we got back to the monastery. So I was reflecting in the last month, I've stayed in like 10 different sleeping places at night. And last night I woke up in the middle of the night. It's a new moon tonight, so it was like completely pitch dark in my room. And I woke up and I had no idea where I was. I was literally questioning, where am I? And instead of turning the light on and looking around and seeing, I just thought I'd just hang out in that not knowing, and there was just this complete void of, there was no reference at all to where I was. And I have a theory, kind of what happens is this has happened to me before in the past where I've been traveling quite a bit. And I think we can get used to certain routines and certain patterns. And for myself, I notice like if I stay in one place for a really long time, there's almost like your body aligns to the magnetic force of the planet or something. So it's like I always sleep with my head facing the Buddha image in my cabin. So it's like it's always oriented in a particular way. I've been in the same cabin for most of the last, say, 2 or 3 years. And so you're just always set in this particular way. And even if I have tried this at times, like even in my cabin, just sleeping, at a 45-degree angle to where I normally do, and it's really hard to fall asleep. So if I'm not in that same alignment. So I think just all this traveling and having been slept in all these different positions, I literally had no concept of where I was, even on the planet. And I was telling somebody this at tea time, and this happened twice before when I was a traveling salesman, where I'd be traveling for like a month, and finally at the end of it, just sort of waking up and not knowing where I was. And the situation was, I was a traveling salesman, and the company had a convention we went to in Los Angeles, and I'd been traveling quite a bit right before this convention, and I woke up in the middle of the night and completely disoriented, and I was thinking, where am I? And I was like, oh, that's right, you're in Buffalo, New York. You had a Red Roof Inn, you're okay. And he just kind of took this sigh of relief, like, okay, I know where I'm at. And then the company I was at was trying to save money, so they were putting two salesmen in the same room, and the other salesman was in the bed next to me, and he rolled over, and I was like, oh my goodness, the Red Roof Inn, they let another person into my room in the middle of the night, and I was like starting to panic, and then all of a sudden I heard some gunshots outside the hotel, and I was like, oh, you're in Los Angeles. So hearing these gunshots sort of was reassuring and made me more peaceful. So I thought that was really a funny perception. Just something dangerous could be like, oh, okay, I'm safe. Just having returned from Louisiana and Mississippi, I didn't know this was going to happen, but I guess on Sunday, I think it's the 19th, there's going to be an Upasaka day, and the theme for that is Tudong, wandering practice. I haven't got a chance to talk to any of the monks to know exactly if they have anything planned or what they're going to talk about. But quite a few community members here have done the wandering practice. And so there's probably lots of stories and lots of expertise, or at least some knowledge of doing that type of practice. And when I heard last year that Ajahn Pasno had been invited to go down to Mississippi, I was intrigued to go down with him to be part of that. and I think most people here know that it was actually 11 years ago I was down in Mississippi. Started in New Orleans, but had attempted to walk from New Orleans. The goal was to reach Thunder Bay, Ontario, Canada, with the kind of the rough idea of following the Mississippi River. And the man who offered to go with me was a lay person, and he took on the eight precepts, like the Anagarikas, so the community members that are wearing white with the shaved heads. So he did that, but we decided it would probably be safer to put him into like more of like a Zen kind of look with gray robes instead of walking around in white robes in the South. We didn't think that would be safe. And so Austin was very happy to do that. And so we went down there and, you know, had mostly positive experiences. And but, you know, I have to admit, or I did even at the time, that, you know, especially the first week or so, probably even the first 2 weeks, I think the main theme that I was working with or dealing with was fear, dealing with the uncertainty and the unknown. And at that point, I think Ajahn Siddhanto had done a walk to Fort Bragg, and maybe Ajahn Pasano had taken a group, maybe with Krunadamo and Obaso at the time, they did a Tudong just heading south from here. So there was a little bit of experience of people trying to do a wandering practice in the United States, but there wasn't much. And typically, like if you were to do this type of practice in Thailand or a Buddhist country, you would wisely seek out someone who'd done it already and maybe go with them, get some expertise. Say Ajahn Nyanico's had that. Had the experience of going with a monk who had a lot of experience and, you know, taught him some really good, you know, techniques. Just things of, like, just how to really, like, look after each other and take care of each other. One thing Ajahn Nyanico mentioned was that, the person that I was walking with was really tall and had a really long walking stride. So I was always afraid to let him go in front because I thought he'd be like, you know, 2 miles ahead of me before I even realized that I wasn't anywhere in sight. And so I kind of always walked first. But Ajahn Nyanico pointed out that like this monk that he was doing Tudong with, every day they'd alternate who would go first. And so to kind of, you know, vary the pace a little bit, but like if you were someone who was, you know, really slow and you know, felt like you were trying to run to catch up to somebody, it can create a lot of, you know, ill will or discomfort and, you know, judgments and things like that. And so, you know, just to alter that, to you know, maybe even kind of learn from each other and see, oh yeah, he does have a different pace than I do. So there's lots of little tips like that that you can learn from someone who's already done the practice before you, that can make a really big difference in how you interact. You know, I see a lot of similarities with that. You know, like just being in a monastery and training. Seeing, you know, other people who've done the training before you. That, you know, if there's things that we're suffering about, there maybe other people have already, you know, seen that and have let go a little bit, or, you know of other little tricks. So there's a lot of, they'll be talking about, you know, some of the things with the Tudong. It's, I think a lot of it, all of it can actually be, you know, applied to how we live, either the monastery or, you know, with people that we work with out in the world, our coworkers or our family even. So on this most recent trip to Mississippi that we just got back from, I was noticing, you know, a lot of changes in the South in general, you know, partly even in my own, you know, comfort level being down there. And there were a lot of reasons it was much more comfortable because we were being driven around instead of having to walk everywhere and having air conditioning and being able to take showers. It's you know, we can take those things for granted, but you know, when you're out there walking and not able to get clean really easily. You know, those the little things can really be quite precious, and we take them for granted. Lumpur's already mentioned this to the community, but you know, the biggest difference that I noticed was that we were actually recognized as Buddhist monks almost everywhere we went, whereas, you know, 10, 11 years ago when I was down there, I don't remember actually anybody acknowledging that or even knowing that I was a Buddhist monk. It was people would recognize that there was some, that you were a religious person, or that you were obviously doing something different, but they nobody actually sort of said, "Oh, you're a Buddhist monk," and so that was a big change. And we did run into Drew, who had been a monk here, who's now living in Mississippi, and I mentioned that to him, and he acknowledged the same thing. Just in the time that he's been back, there's a big shift in attitude around that for him, his experience of that. Then, so you can just kind of give me just a really quick summary of the trip, though. So we flew into met in New Orleans, and immediately was Dolores Watson, who's the founder of the Flowering Lotus Meditation Center in Magnolia, Mississippi. So we were invited to go down and to take a tour of the center and to meet a lot of the people who are on her board of directors, or people that are helping to support that center. And I think there's some sort of hope that that there'll be a stronger connection between that center and Abayagiri. And so it was just sort of an exploratory trip to go down and to see what she's created and to meet those people. So when we got there, we just immediately drove up to Magnolia, Mississippi, and stayed at one of her houses up there. And I think the first or second impression that I got of Mississippi is that it's hot. and so that was it wasn't necessarily a shock, but when I was there before, it was in March, and so even though in the afternoon time it was when we were walking, it would be starting to get uncomfortable even in March, but we were there mid-April, so it was already. Even the couple of people that were helping out with us were saying that it's starting to get hot, but it's nothing compared to like what it'll be in July and August. And so that was like the very first impression, just the amount of water and humidity and the heat. So that was the first impression. It wasn't necessarily negative, but it was just that was the impression. But then I think from there on, I think the overall impression and just things that kept happening after that was just really how open everybody that we met was. There's there is the saying Southern hospitality, and it really is, at least where we were, was a very true experience. And we tried to keep the schedule fairly open and not try to rush to do too many things. So everything just sort of like happened spontaneously. Like we kind of would have one or two things during the day that Dolores really wanted to show us and to do. And it just seemed like from those experiences, like something else would spring up. We'd meet somebody and they'd invite us someplace, or we'd go someplace. Like the first day we went to go to see the center, I think the locks had been changed, so we couldn't actually get in there. So we did something else, which led to just encounters with meeting interesting people. And so I think it was the second morning we were there. We went to a radio. It was the first full day we were there, actually. So we went for a radio interview, And we ended up being a few minutes late, and so they had to take somebody else into our slot, and we were waiting and just met this woman in the lobby, and she was supposed to be interviewed, but we ended up taking her spot. And you can imagine, like, that would be, you know, maybe frustrating for somebody who took time off from work to go to be interviewed, and then we ended up getting her spot, and she didn't. The show ended after us, and so she didn't actually get a chance then to be interviewed. But, you know, her attitude as well, you know, it's like, I think what she actually said was, you know, God works in mysterious ways, or, you know, it's like, that's okay. So it's like, we'll just go with this. And so she was intrigued by us and wanted to talk to us. So she invited us to go to the school that she works at. And it's a fairly new school that was started in Macomb, Mississippi, which I think is probably around 20,000 people. So it wasn't a small town, but it wasn't a city or anything. But there was this teacher there, Dr. Alexander, who's starting a performance arts school, and so we got a tour of it, and they did all the basic requirements that you need to do, English and biology and all of those types of classes, but the focus was definitely on, you know, performance arts and theater, music. They had music rooms and choir, so as we were walking through the school, you know, like all the artwork that was up on the wall were student paintings or student sculptures, and some of them were incredible. It's like, I mean, they really look like professional quality artwork. I was really impressed with it. And so she had called ahead, I think, back to the school to let them know that we were coming for the tour. And say, one of the impressions I also came away with in the South was this, like, if someone invites you to their house or to their business or something like that, they're always giving gifts. You know, like if you're a guest in their house, they're always giving you things. And so the high school choir did a performance for us. They sang two songs, and if I had any hair on my head, it would have been standing on end when they were singing, because there was this little girl sitting in the front row, and I think she probably couldn't have weighed more than 85 pounds or something like that, and she was just belting it out, and it almost hurt my ears. These kids were singing so loud. I was literally like ringing in my ears. But we were watching them, and they were just you could almost, and this is probably isn't the right word to say, but it's almost like they were in a trance. You know, they were just like really feeling the music. They were really putting them in, kind of like an altered state. Not all of them, but you could see it in their, their concentration and their, in the focus in what they were doing. Listening to each other, just like we do with the chanting. Paying attention to each other, so it's just this, really beautiful offering. And then after they asked us to do a chant, which was. It was really nice to do. It was kind of, I think, a letdown after having, it was about somewhere between 60 to 70, students, doing this choral performance, and then having two Buddhist monks chanting the Buddhist words on loving kindness was, the contrast was pretty severe. But afterwards, then we were asked, we opened it up for question and answer. And, one of the things I was asking the students during that, it's like, when they were performing, like what was that experience like for them? Like, were they, I was actually, wanting to know, because it seemed like watching them, it's like you could tell that, like, if they really knew the performance, knew the piece, because I think it started in Latin and then went to an African language and then ended in English, so it was like something that they had definitely memorized and really had down. And I was watching some of them; they looked extremely peaceful, even though it was this. The name of the school was the Jubilee Performing Arts Center, and so that's really jubilant expression. But I was watching a lot of them, and they looked very peaceful when they were in this full-on recital. And so I was asking them, if they, when they're doing that, if it really brings them to a piece of calm and, like being aware of their body and just the energy that comes through them when they do that. And as I was kind of formulating the question that way, I was watching and, quite a few of them were like shaking their head like, oh, wow, like he actually understands that. Like they could, that was their experience. And say then, when we were there, the person who, I guess it was right before we went to the school, though, the person who gave us the radio interview asked us to go and to see her husband's artwork. He had passed away, but their house was kind of like a gallery, and so we went there. And again, it's this whole image, the thing of giving gifts. So she invited us to come to her house, and then she ended up giving us all prints of her husband's work. So that first day is like, we didn't know that we we're going to be going to this, kind of get a private tour of a studio and receive these gifts. And then we didn't know we were going to be going to the performing arts school, and having things like that happen. It was kind of every day, just sort of meeting new people like that. Then I think the highlight, though, for me of the entire trip was the last day we were in Macomb. We had done a few things in the morning and early afternoon, and Dolores just asked if we wanted to go see any other sort of parts of Mississippi, and she recommended a town that was an hour and a half drive away. And I had the map out, and when she mentioned that town, I noticed that the city of Natchez was exactly the same distance away. So I kind of felt like, okay, she wouldn't be averse to driving that far away. And I was very hesitant to ask at the beginning of the trip to go there. But when I did do the Tudong 11 years ago, that was the first place where the Tudong that I was on really took a positive turn. So like I said, the first 2 weeks were really filled with a lot of fear. And we decided to just drive up to this town of Natchez. And it's the southwest corner of Mississippi. And there was this probably 1,000 or 2,000 year old trail that goes from that part of the Mississippi to the north east part of the state, and then goes all the way up to, say, Memphis, Tennessee. It's almost 500 miles long, and it was used by Native Americans for centuries. And then during the development of the United States as a country, the farmers from Ohio and Pennsylvania and Indiana would float all of their wares, in the fall, all the vegetables that they had grown, down to New Orleans. And then they would sell all their rafts for lumber, and then they'd have to walk back. So they'd all walk back up on the Natchez Trace. And so it's actually a national park. It's a 500-mile-long national park. And so we heard about this, and we were having a really hard time finding places to sleep in the first week that we were on the walk. And so we thought, well, let's just skip up ahead and try that. And this afternoon I was going back, and I hadn't read my journals from that walk for about 6 or 7 years, so I went back and was hoping that I'd get some new insights reading it. We started in, say, in Natchez, and I think it must have been like 50 or 60 miles to Jackson, the capital of the state. And I wrote, I said, that was our Tudong. Before it had been to get from New Orleans to Canada, but all of a sudden the Tudong just became, can we just get from Natchez to Jackson? And if we can do that, then we'll reevaluate what we're going to do. It started becoming much more like, okay, let's be in the present moment instead of trying to do this 1,800-mile walk. And so the first day that we were dropped off there, I remember it was the weather was really bad, and so Austin and I just stayed under our tarps for the day, and it kind of cleared up, and then I went for a walk through this kind of park area that we were at, and I was just really filled with fear. I remember just like, almost shaking, sort of walking, because we'd just gotten dropped off in the rural Mississippi. We didn't know anybody, wasn't sure how, we hadn't been, say, abused or anything, but we felt really unsafe in Louisiana, and so we were dropped off in Mississippi, and really, you know, I was quite concerned, and but walking through the forest, and all of a sudden I just remembered that the teachings of Ajahn Mun and his going on Tudong, and you know, he was known for, he'd be given a little bit of responsibility. For like say being an abbot of a monastery or asked to take on some duties, and he would just disappear. He would just head off into the jungle. He wouldn't tell anybody where he was going, and there's stories of Ajahn Tate like seeking him for quite a long time, like a year, trying to find him just so he could ask him a Dhamma question, and then in his one of the biographies of Ajahn Mun, he talks about how he would encourage the monks to go off into the jungle just to face their fears, a lot of it, to take themselves out of their comfort level and to go out and face the unknown, and so as soon as I had this realization, I was like, oh, wow, it's like, all this fear that I'm facing and all the uncertainty, all the unknown, this is exactly what Ajahn Mun would have encouraged me to do, to go out and to sort of, as I always call it, pushing the envelope of the what's normal, what's acceptable, what's comfortable. And so that kind of turned my mood slightly. And then I was remembering that actually Lumpur had encouraged me for the walk to use loving kindness as a main sort of meditation technique, and I really we'd been doing it just a little bit at times, but it hadn't been like my main focus. And then as soon as I remember that, I was like, oh, I got really excited, and so I went back to where we were had our tarp set up, and remember giving Austin some instructions on how to do that. We talked about it for most of that afternoon and then started practicing it, the rest of that day for sure. And then the next morning we realized we were out of food. And so we were like, okay, well, we got to start walking today. And we had a map that, showed some towns and things. And then we got onto the trace, actually for the first time started walking. And I think it was about 5 mile walk that morning. We got to this place called Locust Hill, where it was a cabin that was used. It was kind of a historical marker, and we went there. And we've been doing, using loving kindness as we were walking along. And typically, as a monk, we're encouraged like not to be making eye contact with people, to be kind of our eyes downcast and not sort of like drawing attention to ourselves, but doing this loving kindness practice, and partly too, the road is not much bigger than say like Tom Kai Road, just a little bit bigger. It's nicer condition, but so I just decided as we were walking that I would just make eye contact with the cars coming, just to make sure they see us. But then I was noticing that the people have these really strange expressions on their faces when they'd see us. And so I just decided to smile and just sort of just give them a wave. And I kind of said, it's just, the wave is just sort of like, thanking them for sort of moving away a little bit. And people would see me smiling and they would smile. And so I was like, so it's kind of raised my spirits a little bit as well. So, but I was just, just using that as loving kindness practice of just, waving to people as they drove by. And then, so I was feeling, better, a little happier. And then we got to this place, Locust Hill, and it's a little bit of a walk off from the road, but we decided to go up there anyway. And there was quite a few people there at that point in the morning, and we were talking to one of the rangers and asking him, like this next town that's up ahead, are we going to be able to, go on alms around there. And He's like, oh, there's nothing there. He said, that town's just, it's not even, there's, you know, it's like it's, there's a, it's labeled on the map, but there's nothing there, not even, you know, maybe like some abandoned buildings was it. So we're like, well, where's the next, you know, town that's got like a grocery store? And it was like 20 miles away. So we're like, okay, we're not going to eat today. Well, we can get maybe most of the way there, and then we'll try to get there the next day. And we were completely fine with that. And then we said, well, let's just go up to the, look at the, this cabin anyway. And we got up there, and there were some retired men that were there, and they were taking their new Catholic priest to kind of show him around the area. He had come from India so they were showing him around, and they got really intrigued by us, and they started asking us, you know, what we were and what we were doing. And then we walked back with them, you know, heading, we were getting ready to start walking, and they just spontaneously sort of asked, oh, do you guys need a ride anywhere? So we're like, yeah. So we figured we'd already skipped like 100 miles to Louisiana, so it's like, okay, we can skip another, you know, 10 miles or so. And then, but that interaction with them just really, you know, completely changed. That morning was the morning of, you know, starting to use loving kindness as the meditation practice, and then meeting them. And they were the first people that we'd actually seen on the whole walk that actually, you know, spontaneously had questions and were interested in what we were doing. And so it was this, yeah, really positive memory and kind of a, in my kind of mind, it was like it was a really special place. So then we got there, and you know, and I was fortunate. It didn't take much persuasion, but talked the group into going to that spot. And it was, I was almost in tears when I was walking around the place. And I think it was probably funny for Lumpur, because I was trying to explain to him like what the place looked like. And we get up there, and it's like, it doesn't look like what I remembered. And I remember this big open deck and like two buildings on either side. And we walked around the back, and sure enough, it was what I remembered looking like in the back. So it was a fun seeing how memory had changed from the spots. But being there at that spot was a really, you know, very strong emotional encounter. And then the last story I'll kind of tell is that then when we left there, and we went into Natchez itself to just kind of, one thing, it's also the South, the architecture is just, some of the buildings is just phenomenal. It's like just the really, really beautiful homes. And so Dolores wanted to kind of show us around these areas. And then we decided to head back. And our driver was getting kind of tired, so he wanted some coffee. And we couldn't find any place that was open. And so we were, you know, driving around, and I saw this shop that some lights on anyway, and looked like kind of like a restaurant. It was like a hotel that I thought maybe had a restaurant. So I talked Danny into pulling over, and then we walked up, and it was obviously like a bread and breakfast hotel area. But I decided just to walk in, just to ask the woman that was working at the counter if there was any place that would sold coffee. And so she started thinking about it, and she remembered a place and wasn't sure if they were open. So there was some doubt there. And then she's trying to give me directions. And even though she's from Natchez, she's not 100% sure where it was. And then she just looks at me and she says, you just want a cup of coffee, right? And I was like, well, yeah, there's like three or four of them. She says, why don't I just brew you a pot? We're like, really? And she's like, oh yeah, no problem. She said they only had a couple of guests, and they were out on the town that night. And she said, you know, I have nothing to do for the next couple hours, so yeah, just come on in. So we all went in. She took us into like the dining room area, you know, really, really nice, cozy atmosphere. And she goes off and starts the coffee and comes out. And she's local, so she starts telling us about the history of the town and telling us, you know, all about a little bit about her life, which was interesting. And then her and Dolores made a really strong connection, and Dolores was able to, you know, give her card, and, you know, told her if she's ever in New Orleans or Magnolia that, you know, Dolores is going to take care of her and put her up. And so it's just this really nice, you know, sort of connection there. And it's just, again, that sort of the hospitality of people. It's like, you know, just, you know, needing a helping hand, or, you know, so, just, you know, needing some information, And you know, she could have just said, you know, there's that coffee shop and I think it's here, or, you know, you guys have an iPhone, why don't you figure out where it is, you know, that kind of attitude. But, you know, just she took that extra step of, you know, sort of taking care of us, and I think she probably enjoyed, you know, the interaction as much as we did. But so just a few stories there of that trip, and there's you know, others too that I could mention. You know, as I was thinking about what I would, you know, or how to talk about these things, it did remind me when I was reading the little bit of the journal that I kept 10 years ago, that I was quoting John Steinbeck's book "Travels with Charlie," and one thing that kind of became the at least in that book, one of the things he points out is it's like, you know, anytime you're taking a journey, it's like you know, if you try to control it, if you, you know, like have a preconceived idea of like, you know, how the journey is going to go, you know, where we're going to stay, who we're going to stay with, and, you know, trying to fill in all these details, you know, that you know, you're, it's like, he didn't say it this way, but, you know, you're going to it creates dukkha, creates tension. You know, it's like kind of resisting how that journey is going to unfold, and just sort of, you know, going more with that sort of open receptivity. And, you know, sort of seeing that with the trip with Dolores, you know, there were a few minors, you know, two things a day that we definitely wanted to do. And that was good because it gave it a structure, gave it something to, you know, sort of fit our day around. But almost all of the really powerful things that happened and the people that we met, those are all almost completely spontaneous. That you know, had no idea that was going to happen, and in the interactions with people. And so I was kind of thinking, you know, in the same way with, you know, just the training here, the you know, living in a monastery or visiting a monastery. You know, it's like yeah, we do have the forms and the structures, and but, you know, the more we have preconceived ideas of the way it should be, or, you know, the things we want to do, then, you know, that gets in the way and creates, you know, the tension. But, you know, the more that we can, you know, just be open to, you know, what actually is happening, being present, and, you know, a good way of doing that is, you know, paying attention to each other, you know, sort of taking the focus off of what it is we want to do or what we want, but yeah, just seeing when there's a need to help out, or just being receptive in that way. So I think I've spoken more than I was planning to, so I'll end the talk there. Om Namah Shivaya.